Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth web-based study of the Urantia book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 165, section 4, paragraph 7. We're in the picturesque land beyond the Jordan, virtually following after Jesus during his last ministry work in the flesh. What a transcendent service if, through this revelation, the Son of Man should be recovered from the tomb of traditional theology and be presented as the living Jesus. I'm Brad Garner, and I'm so glad that you've joined us here this evening, this Tuesday evening, or at our archive, symmetryofsoul.org. With me, as always, Andrea Barnes, Kermit Anderson, and Dr. Chris Halverson. Dr. Chris is our teacher, and the rest of us, we are those able and willing students here, as we hope that you are, too. Please call up the text of the Urantia book by whatever means you deem appropriate and take a virtual seat with us as we spend about 1% of our week seeking a more philosophic understanding of our place in the cosmos. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Hello, Andrea and Kermit. Everyone who can join us. And we are going to be jumping back into the middle of this little discourse on wealth that Jesus has found himself in the midst of, unbeknownst to his expectations for the day. Lots of additional items and also some very famous passages will be examined to see how they compare to what humans have always thought they were talking about.
We're looking forward to it. I think wealth, riches, and treasure are a topic that comes up in social conversation, and we all can talk about it extensively. Let's find out how the master engaged conversation, the endless desire for conversation about this here. And Andrea, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Good evening, Brad. I'm just doing really well, thank you. I am here to be the able and willing student, and I'm looking forward to tonight's study.
Very good. Very well. Glad to have you with us as always. And Kermit, we're glad that you're here always too, giving us a little bit of perspective on what we covered the previous week and helping out each always do. How are you, sir?
Doing fine. Thank you, Brad. And hello to Andrea and Chris, and especially our chat room who's got a veteran has returned after a relatively long absence. Good to see him back in there, and everyone on the switchboard. And it is nice to have daylight out there finally with the daylight savings time change. We now have the sun as we head into our review here yet again, and not for the last time. Symmetry of Soul proceeded with further exploration of the appearance reality issue, noting that determinations based on appearance, sight, yield beliefs. Reality is more profitably approached through an exercise of genuine faith and cultivation of insight. Symmetry of Soul speaks often about the revelation being a philosophic text which provides a true metaphysics in synthetic harmony with valid human philosophy. Applying this kind of thinking to parts 1 through 3 of the revelation comes more easily than it does to part 4. In this arc, we are trying to bring this kind of philosophic inquiry to part 4, which goes beyond the details and facts of Jesus' doings 2,000 years ago to reach his truth for us today. The analysis of parts, facts, does not lead to comprehension of the whole, truth. With the whole, big picture, in mind as a context for parts, true relationships can be the more correctly understood. Adjutant mind, unaided by the encirclement in the Holy Spirit, is incapable of penetrating to a correct understanding of these issues, let alone comprehending truth. Bearing this in mind, going forward, why does Jesus in the Sermon on the Good Shepherd refer to true shepherds, with good referring only to the food with which the true shepherds are to feed the flocks? The individuality of goodness of a good shepherd attains a more enduring quality and universal application in a true shepherd. We began our reading in section 3 of paper 165, Sabbath Sermon at Pella. In this memorable sermon on trust and spiritual preparedness, the Master makes bold to call out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees while acknowledging those Pharisees who are actually honest of heart and number among his disciples. He speaks with an urgency inasmuch as less than 3 months remain before he terminates his bestowal on the cross. He refers to an unveiling of heretofore hidden matters, including both the machinations of his enemies to bring about his demise and bestowals of the powerful spirit ministries attendant upon his departure. Throughout our discussion, we are reminded of the tendency for the material gravity of the facts and details to distract us from the big picture, underscoring the need for maintaining equilibrium between material and spiritual gravity, thereby avoiding the extremes of imbalance, cynicism, or fanaticism. This sermon is represented in the New Testament Gospel of Luke. Comparison of the two treatments illustrate the degree to which the Master's message of fear not and fear none in heaven and earth was entrapped in the old wineskins of fear of the Lord and the destiny of damnation for sinners, instead of the liberating invitation to participate in progressive perfection attainment through the free will dedication of your will to the Father's will. The far greater precision found in the fifth epical revelation clarifies the real meaning of the biblical passage referring to the so-called unforgivable sin of blaspheming the Holy Spirit, portraying it more truthfully as a free will choice of deliberately rejecting divine forgiveness. Knowing what lies ahead for his disciples and apostles, Jesus commands them to fear not when they are brought before the enemies of the kingdom, and assures them that their indwelling spirit will instruct them what they should say in honor of the gospel of the kingdom. The Master concludes with an appeal for his listeners then and now to enter joyfully into their spiritual inheritance of sonship with the eternal God. He further reminds that he has certainly revealed the Father to us. It remains in our free will hands to enter the kingdom. We began section 4, we did not complete it, dividing the inheritance. While many of his hearers went to be baptized in the Jordan, the Master remained behind and entertained questions from those who remained. A young man sought his help in garnering a large inheritance due him. Jesus responded with a story of a rich man who made provision for the accumulation of material riches, but neglected to lay up treasures in heaven. Careful reading and further discussion considered the precision of language in the revelation. Distinction in our discussion was made between riches, wealth, and treasure. Jesus drew distinction between material riches and wealth, the love thereof which is covetousness, and the danger of converting wealth of material possessions into treasures which can absorb interest and divert affections and devotion to spiritual pursuits of the kingdom. The elevation of material wealth into a preoccupation of the heart, spiritualized mind, is the path towards making riches and wealth your master rather than your servant. And here ends the summary.
Thank you, Kermit. You ended powerfully with strong watchwords for a material comfort era, for sure. As I said, we all seem to enjoy talking about riches, wealth, and treasure, and what is God's perspective on them, what was Jesus's perspective on them, and we're going to get even more of that tonight. Helpful conversation, for sure. Almost as much of a popular subject with Jesus as the subject of evil, but, you know, we're prone to our particular fun little topics as humans. Anything on anyone's mind? Technical clarifications? What's up?
No, just to say thank you for the review, Kermit. I thought it was really well done. Thanks.
Thank you.
And maybe just to emphasize, you know, that issue of you're just bringing up, Brad. You know, what's God's thoughts on, you know, what's the Universal Father's thoughts on riches, wealth, and treasures? As Jesus tried to remind us, he's our spiritual father, not our material father. So your first clue is there. It's like, let's see. When I think of riches, I don't think about, blobs of spirit substance. And then the other issue is, I think Kermit brought it up with covetousness. That, what you might call, love of riches. In particular, it's love of someone else's riches. That reminds you of the key issue. I mean, love is, in its genuine form, a spirit word. It relates to the uppermost reaches of your inner life, engaging spirit energy, is far removed from your raccoon-like, animal origin-like fascination with shiny material objects. And, God doesn't have any thoughts about, riches and wealth and treasures per se. If you direct your potential to love at material objects instead of at spirit, and through spirit to him, then he knows you not.
Mm.
Right? It's not a matter of he's got some issue, with, what you're loving. Again, he relates to you just existentially. Either you exist or you don't in terms of how you're identifying. Right? You either identify towards him or 180 degrees away from him, and don't expect that, you are in any sort of an interplay if your back is faced to him.
Right.
So,
I felt like a raccoon the other day. I walked into a department store and they had all the rings and the bracelets and the necklaces and all the diamonds were sparkling, the lights were shining on it. And so when you said raccoon, I thought of that moment.
Hopefully you didn't snitch a bunch of them, stick them in your little pile that you've got, like hidden in the wall boards or something.
No.
Don't do that.
They were firmly behind
the glass. I'm reminded of... what was I just thinking of? It was some movie or some sort of a movie quote I saw. Maybe it was from a play where I'm reminded of when they tell us that children are permanently impressed by the loyalties of their parents. And there's a quote in whatever play it is I'm thinking of where the grown child looks at his parent and the parent says, don't you remember all the things that I taught you? And he says, you showed me exactly what you cared about, and the bottom line, the dollar bill. And that's what he remembers. So that's that loyalty. That's that love of riches that children will notice in their parents.
Right.
Yeah.
They will pick up on that loyalty. It doesn't matter how many contrary words you toss out. Right.
Yeah.
The child is post roughly age six, the more that will happen, right? They have insight. They can penetrate through your fog of words and see, what lies behind them, emptiness or substance. And they won't pick up on that. They won't be aware of what they're picking up with on through their insight. They won't be aware of that consciously.
Mm-hmm.
But it will make an impression upon them, a lasting impression. Because, for a child to exercise its insight, that's more tied to eternity, than its sight, or its ears, for your words, tied to time. So it's going to have a lasting impression because of its relationship to eternity.
That's why the loyalty is a permanent impression. It's tied to eternity, not a precept, not an example, but you're bound to time.
Right. It's not all that stuff that you see, hear, taste, smell, whatnot. Yeah, they're all tied to time.
Yeah. Well, one thought that I had, it's been kind of brewing for a couple of weeks. As we've gotten back into part four here, which is evocative in its language, sometimes in very little subtle ways. I think it was last week or the week before, for some reason, just a little flourish they made about how Jesus taught the multitudes every morning at 9 a.m. unless it was raining. There was something about just a little, the invocation of a gentle morning rain shower that maybe it reminded me of something in my own life, but just sort of helped me put myself in the boots of that time and place a little bit. And it's one the basic thought that I had was, I hope this is humility. I hope it isn't false humility, and I hope it isn't hopeless humility. Time and time again in part four, we read, they did not comprehend his teachings. They could not grasp the meaning of Jesus' teaching. And we can all read that here and now and, you know, sort of tut tut and say, yeah, but we have a Urantia book and we grasp the meaning of his teachings. I'm not so sure that I do. So that's what we're working on here. I'm having a Socratic moment now with part four. I'm constantly having those with the book, but here I am, not sure I'm comprehending what the master is really saying, but trying to.
Yeah, and just a little side note on, and then, why toss in the comment about, unless it was raining? Right, I mean, every little thing that the midwares can do to gently challenge the assumption that they know every reader has going into reading part four. You know, they're looking for more details about their favorite fetish man.
Right.
And, it's like, he controls the elements and everything. Right. He's like all of the elemental gods and everything all rolled into one. No, if it's raining, he gets overruled.
By a cloud.
Right.
By a cloud.
Wow, I didn't think of it that way.
Michael of Nebadon laid low by, some nucleated moisture. that's why that stuff is there, right?
Yeah.
Fundamentally, directly. Yeah, and then the fact that it also, right, does what you're saying, has all those connotations, that enrich the picture in your mind, and cause you to think of parallels and associations and whatnot. Okay, all the better.
Sure.
But, if it rains, he gets wet. it's just, think about how little, thought there's been, as I often bring up. Remember, it wasn't until the fourth century that they started celebrating, the church started celebrating his birthday. That's how little immediate care there was for Jesus the man.
Yeah.
All right. The true man, right? Not the fetish man.
Right.
And, and by the fourth century, people, it had gone well beyond fetish man. He was just some mystical spirit cloud, right? We just don't appreciate how quickly people were going off on a fuzzed out tangent,
right.
Because we grew up in a culture that, my favorite, holiday is Christmas because I get presents, right? But between the lines of that, if you do end up thinking about Jesus, right, you go, that's right. I've always appreciated that holiday for the presents, but that's actually a celebration of when he was born. He was in his mother's womb and he was born. And right, it gets you grounded right from the start you know, if you consider Jesus.
Right.
But, you know, that's not the way it started out in those first few centuries. You know, everyone was floating off on a mystical tangent.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's still with us. You know, I am sure every Sunday there are sermons preached all around the world about just two words Jesus said on the cross, "I thirst." Like, oh, what did he mean by that? Like, he was thirsty. But no. Let's talk for 60 minutes about what God on the cross really meant. No, it was Jesus on the cross, and he was thirsty.
Right. See, so everything is, because he's a fetish man, everything's an allegory, you know, and it's just, it's just amazing, you know, this tendency that people have.
Yeah. So it goes.
And in terms of challenging lots of preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices about Jesus, our opening paragraph will get us going on that.
Yeah, we can get going on that. If there isn't anything else, we can get right into it. It's a fitting opening paragraph. Anything else? All right. Going once, twice, three times. All right. It's paper 165 of the Urantia book, The Perean Mission Begins. And we are picking up in the middle of section 4, which is dividing the inheritance. And we're at paragraph 7, page 1822 of the original single column text. Jesus did not teach nor countenance improvidence, idleness, indifference to providing the physical necessities for one's family, or dependence upon alms. But he did teach that the material and temporal must be subordinated to the welfare of the soul and the progress of the spiritual nature in the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, so, you know, the second sentence, you know, we obviously can and invoke, seek first the kingdom of heaven and such. But we'll see this come back around again, that first sentence. We get into the next section. Yeah, this touches upon one of the most problematic takeaways that the early followers of Jesus, you know, went off on a tangent on from his life. That there must be some issue at hand, or the midwayers wouldn't feel the need to put that first sentence in there. Why are they telling me Jesus did not teach nor countenance? many people have said that Jesus taught or countenanced X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
This whole issue again, like we were just talking about with the material in contrast to the spiritual, the more you say Jesus taught something or other about, generalize and say economic issues, right, the more you're turned 180 degrees from what he was actually here teaching.
Right. And people try to constantly drag him into those nets. What about riches? What about politics? What about this? What about this worldly problem?
Yes, as I hinted in, when you introduced me, Brad, you know, here Jesus is looking towards trying to really focus on the spiritual, and the first question out of the gate is, yeah.
Help me get
my
money.
My brother got all the inheritance, and I've been really ripped off, you know. Can you smite him, Master? it's so difficult to get an animal origin creature to refound their thoughts. Right? They're naturally founded from the material up. We're humans. We're up from the humuses. Yeah, and it's just so unnatural to go 180 degrees from that natural beginning. And and be interested in something besides, all the material fall-for-all. But then the second sentence, so that it's not put into a dichotomy, right? It's just starting there. There's two elements, but one is superordinate and one is subordinate.
Yeah.
One is above and the other is below. That which is below is not, dismissed, ignored, whatever. But the point is to bring truth in behind your considerations of the material, right? Which means you have to start with the spiritual.
Right. Subordinate it. Don't dismiss it or don't suppress it. That's unreal. That's ignoring reality to do those things. It's here.
Right.
It's below. It's existent. Right. Yeah. It doesn't say, that it's, unordinated.
Right.
Or immaterial.
Right. Yeah, to coin a term. And just think about, just pause for a moment. It's like when they say Jesus did not teach nor countenance improvidence. Just pause for a second. Okay, what are we literally talking about there? Not too long ago, we spent a lot of time talking about the word providence when we were, talking about the Supreme. Right. Did he teach, rejection, or the non-importance of foresight?
Yeah, right. Planning ahead.
Providence.
Right.
Especially if he's trying to be a spiritual uplifter, and if you short circuit, an initial sense that you have that can get you reflectively to consider the existence of spirit, right? It's that foresight tendency, right, that you have because of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit and your gift of personality. Right, so think about how unwise that would be to teach improvidence, right? And to just, lay there on your back and wait for the dates of alms to drop into your mouth.
Yeah.
Pardon the
pun. That wouldn't be helpful.
Date palms and date alms.
I missed that.
But just, that, see, and of course, we all know there's a long tradition of these sorts of thoughts about quote unquote religious teachers. An overemphasis on navel gazing.
Right. Right. Including Jesus, because of the fragmentary narrative we got of him in the Bible, we don't get all the backstory of everything that the apostles did, the apostolic funds. There's a treasurer, there's all of these logistics he provided for his family when he went off. All that's missing. So we're like, okay, I guess Jesus just said, don't worry about it. Live for today.
Yeah, it's just, there's so many, why they spend so much time on talking about how, how much thought and planning Jesus put into the material needs of his family.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to say something, Kermit.
Well, I was just thinking about these gospels of prosperity that pop up from time to time, which appear to, if you think about what was operational back in these days, was that wealth and material possessions were like the badge of God's favor, that having these things was proof that God saw you favorably and allowed you to accumulate these things. And then there's the seemingly opposite teaching. We just read, about how consider, well, I guess we're going to get that tonight, aren't we?
Yeah.
The lilies of the field.
Yeah,
but
we will.
The idea that, but the idea that don't worry about what you're going to eat or drink. Don't worry about what the future, taking care of your material needs for the future. So
I wonder if you're hinting at why I said we'd come back to this first sentence.
Yeah. But they talked about it up here, too. Last week we touched on that too. But you can see why people can easily misunderstand truth when you try and bring it down to the dead level of material grounding. You really have to have the eye of truth to decipher these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a reason why I'm sort of, dragging this out, letting us dwell on this a little bit, so that this needs to be an important framing of one's thoughts as we go forward tonight. So that in reframing, of our thoughts, because we just don't appreciate how much we've been indoctrinated. Otherwise, right? It's very easy to think of Jesus as being the author of our mores about improvidence, idleness, indifference to providing, etc. When you're on a religious mission,
right?
He did not teach dependence upon alms.
Yeah.
Et cetera. Now, not only did he not teach, he didn't countenance it.
Yeah.
Right? So, lest you think, maybe not active, but passive. It's like, no, neither. Just to make sure this is sort of firmly in mind as one considers what else he says, lest you put it in these old 2,000-year-old wineskins.
Yeah, I got the sparrows and the lilies mixed up.
Oh, you don't want that to happen during a magic trick.
Not to mention the raven.
Sparrows were last week.
And the other little thing, just a note, that second sentence, but he did teach that the material and temporal, so notice they explicitly put both those elements in there, dantically parallel that with spiritual and eternal. But they expect you to fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Right? And just, to stress that again, right? Because they've opened up the door for you to put things in old wineskins by just saying the spiritual nature. Right? Because for a million years, humans have equated the word spiritual with some sort of fancy temporal.
Yeah.
Not total contrast of the temporal. I'm being so spiritual right now.
Right now?
I'm feeling so spiritual right now. Right, just that, see? No, that's not what the word spiritual refers to. So, yeah, it's a, yeah, just also to challenge that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Listen to someone using the word spiritual and ask yourself a simple question. Does that person know of that which they speak? Is it obvious that they have some sort of temporal consideration in mind? See, then they don't. They know not of that which they speak. Maybe you shouldn't follow them to the ends of the earth.
Yeah. They say spiritual, but they are signifying an elaborate material ritual involving smoke and other material objects. Is that, is that truly spiritual?
You know, and if not, you know, the religion of matter like that, it's a religion of mind word.
Of mind. Sure.
Right? It's a religion of matter or a religion of mind word. No one has religion of spirit so that they're genuinely using the word spiritual. They have religion of matter or religion of mind.
You can't say nobody.
But they're still using the word spiritual. Well, again, it's... Can I go to the dictionary? Can I go to a sacred text and find a dissertation on the properties of spirit substance?
No. Will that ever be possible on this earth?
It's just the only reason there's some validity to, you know, like you're saying, a few people perhaps using the word spirit. It's not because of themselves, it's in spite of themselves. Right? They have a hold of a bit of the shadow of the substance, right? Just by grace, right? We have the shadow, but by grace we don't have the substance. You have to take delight in cultivating to get the substance.
Right.
Right? That's that whole bit about evolutionary religion. It's like, you know, the only reason you aren't always putting quotes around the word religion is because you stuck the word evolutionary in front of it. Right? It's quote unquote religion, but the substance is super conscious.
Yeah.
One should err on the side of assuming that you do not know of that which you speak, you know, lest it go to your head and you pridefully begin your journey. Right? That it never an issue to err on the side of humility and assume you are poor rather than rich.
Mm-hmm.
Blessed are the poor in spirit.
Right. All right.
Or to be more precise, happy. Right. But that's another story.
We did those.
Anyway,
this is a great
opening paragraph. Kermit mentioned it in the review. Right? You want to challenge your concept frame before you read. You know, if you just, I can hardly wait to put these new words in my old concept frame, what does it say next? If that's the way you start, why bother?
You're not going to get
you want behold all things to become new. So you need to have some opening salvo of a challenge to your concept frame before you start engaging the revelation, no matter what you're reading.
Yeah, and those concept frames change. They change as you go through. You know, my concept frame didn't include God when I first started reading the Urantia book. And I had to readjust my concept frame to allow for God to exist. That was allowing the idea of God into my mm-hmm. concept frame. That's all it took, okay. actually. The rest, God did the rest.
But, you know, like you were saying, that you can always improve your concept frame, no matter how spiffy it is.
Yeah, always a work in progress.
Yeah, so to just constantly be seeking a recognition that requires a bigger concept frame. You know, this time when I read it, I'm not going to be satisfied with it. You know, just perfectly fitting in my old concept frame. I'm going to draw the walls back, and now that, you know, I'm missing a whole bunch. Right? It doesn't fit anymore. Right?
No.
The sum of my old thoughts just falls right through because it, you know, doesn't cling to the frame.
Yeah.
So well, you want to expand it out until it rubs against the frame again and holds on.
Yeah, and another really good example is this this deity and reality frame that you have cultivated in our studies over the last 10 years, more recently actually. But that's a concept frame that is continually challenging and mm-hmm. continually morphing. I thought I had the three energies pretty well nailed down until yeah. I read more carefully that they're absolutes and they don't interact unless they're coordinated through the Trinity. And this, oops, where, how'd that happen? So, oh, deity,
yeah,
okay.
Magic. You were a yeah. fan of magic, yeah.
yeah.
And just, yeah, when you're trying to somehow wrap your mind around the contrast between deity and reality, yeah, how successful is that going to be if you haven't really gotten the contrast between time and eternity dealt with yet? And then you're still using the word spiritual for some fancy temporal, you know, if not material, issue.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I'll grant you there's a lot of people that, you know, it isn't directly material anymore that they use the word spiritual for. Okay, but it is temporal in their mind, right? It's a temporal something or other in the religion of mind. And there's things, see, there's some very difficult philosophic challenges here. And remember, the best so-called philosophic minds that have ever lived, at the best they've gotten a recognition of two elements, matter and mind. Okay, so this isn't something that's just kind of waiting for you to pick up off the floor where the last
right.
person dropped it. Okay, you're breaking whole new ground, right, to have some consistent and harmonious sense of a threefold actuality. So that there's some validity to your use of the word spiritual, right? You know, it's distinguished in your conception from mindal and material. I mean,
yeah.
there's some very, very fancy spirit-like mindal, right, that you've got to work your way through to get to genuine spiritual. I mean, for instance, your entire, you know, inner life in that spiritualized mind. Okay, if by the AL suffix on spiritual you mean like, okay, you've got it. But if you mean
right.
of, you don't have it. Right? And see, when they're talking about spiritual nature here in the kingdom of heaven, you know, you actually want to make sure you're not just thinking, you know, bottom-up engagement of spirit-like, spiritualized mind. Right? You want to think about that from the top down, where you start with that which is not mind at all, not you at all, spirit substance, spirit energy above your mind, and then see the spiritualization of your inner life anew, right? Starting with the source, spirit substance, you know, and recognizing the influence of that energy on your mind energy. See, and it's that sort of reciprocal transformation that you want to challenge yourself. And it involves, you know, how many times do we end up, you know, tossing out time is not a reality and things like that? It actually involves some very difficult philosophic issues. You have to genuinely get to eternity. You know, if you've absolutized time, you can't get out of it to eternity. Right? It goes forever.
All the way. Yeah.
Conceptually,
it's all time.
Then.
Yeah.
Right.
So
it's a reality.
That
then there is. It's impossible for you to conceive of eternity, really.
Eternity is just endless time, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, see, right? You just rationalize it temporally, see? Because you can't get to the substance of it. There is no absolute of time. The absolute of time is eternity, if you will, like they say. Right?
Right.
So, I know I'm kind of belaboring this, but... this is what you want to be searching for, is little vignettes of opportunity that they might toss at you amidst all of the discussions of what Jesus did on Tuesday and, you know, who he did it with. When the midwayers give you a little philosophic opportunity, right? They set it apart by large paragraph breaks here, and it's like, let's step out of the narrative for a moment and make this more generalized statement. They're trying to get you to, you know, to approach the rest of what they say from the top down instead of, right, the old way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, people, you know, Jesus' listeners were so bottom up in their interpretation of him. You know, when he talked about the bread of life, right, that turned into give us this day our daily bread.
Yeah. Right.
In the Lord's Prayer.
Right.
Something about a bunch of loaves of bread, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, is it wheat or is it rye? you know.
Barley.
And it's like, oh, dear me.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that, you know, the fact that that's the line in, you know, in the established Lord's Prayer, right, is exactly like, let's talk about the spiritual. And the opening question is, so my brother and his inheritance.
Right. Yeah.
See, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about the bread of life. Oh, you mean the bread for dinner? Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah, because my stomach is growling. Right. Right. Man, primitive man only thought when he was hungry. you know, and so Jesus, okay, for Pete's sake, here's some bread. Okay, is your stomach still growling? Okay, no, good. Maybe we can, for a couple minutes before it starts growling again, we can talk about something else.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
But I'm not thinking anymore. Yeah, I know you are.
Yeah, good thing they didn't have a lot of shiny objects back then.
Imagine if Jesus wore, you know, a shiny concentric circle breastplate, you know. they wouldn't have heard a word he said. Yeah, we joke about this, but you know, it's you know, you want to try to use humor so that you have a little bit more courage to challenge yourself, because we need to challenge ourselves, right? And and recognize that that other guy we're chuckling about is us,
right? Right.
And that's the purpose of humor, to make it easier to find the courage to face one's limited starting point. All right.
Okay.
Meanwhile, back in the narrative.
Meanwhile, back to this kid. Then, as the people went down by the river to witness the baptizing, the first man came privately to Jesus about his inheritance, inasmuch as he thought Jesus had dealt harshly with him. And when the master had again heard him, he replied, "My son, why do you miss the opportunity to feed upon the bread of life on a day like this in order to indulge your covetous disposition? Do you not know that the Jewish laws of inheritance will be justly administered if you will go with your complaint to the court of the synagogue? Can you not see that my work has to do with making sure that you know about your heavenly inheritance? Have you not read the scripture? There is he who waxes rich by his weariness and much pinching, and this is the portion of his reward. Whereas he says, 'I have found rest and now shall be able to eat continually of my goods,' yet he knows not what time shall bring upon him, and also that he must leave all these things to others when he dies. Have you not read the commandment, 'You shall not covet'? And again, 'They have eaten and filled themselves and waxed fat, and then did they turn to other gods?' Have you read in the Psalms that the Lord abhors the covetous, and that the little a righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked? If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. Have you read where Jeremiah said, 'Let not the rich man glory in his riches'? And Ezekiel spoke truth when he said, 'With their mouths they make a show of love, but their hearts are set upon their own selfish gain.'"
Wow, he just unloaded both barrels of the Hebrew scriptures on him, on the poor lad.
Yeah, he did. Whole kit and caboodle. Yeah.
Double barrel.
We can see... It's like, okay, if you're going to press this more, I'm going to be more direct. I'm going to really emphasize, the covetousness. Okay, I'm going to brand that across your forehead and see how it feels to you. So you can imagine there's some squirming going on. Right, as the red hot branding iron, lays in. It's always interesting when Jesus gets a little bit more, direct with someone that isn't his 12 apostles.
Yeah, he usually saved that kind of rebuking to those closest to him, whom he knew they could take it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little bit difficult for us to even appreciate. I mean, how cutting it is for him to say, "Have you not read the commandment, 'You shall not covet'?"
Yeah, like it's
I mean,
the,
that's...
The big ten in
the Hebrew scriptures. I don't think I recall that.
Yeah, right. Like the Bill of Rights, man. It's the first 10.
Right. That would be, yes, yeah. Followed by a whole list of what that other guy has that you're drooling over. It's interesting that he's being very direct. And of course, how does he start out, just like we were talking? Why do you miss the opportunity to feed upon the bread of life on a day like this? The bread of life.
Yeah.
To indulge your covetous disposition. Yeah. And he obviously deemed it he needed to be rather direct. Now, in terms of what he unleashes on him, just a little aside here is worthy to note. Have you not read the scripture, it says? And that opening one, right, if you're steeped in very, very minimalistic Protestantism.
You've not seen that book. It's huge.
That first quote, right, that's from the Old Testament Apocrypha.
Oh, really?
Hirach.
He waxes rich by his weariness.
Right.
He who waxes rich by his weariness. I love that one.
Yeah.
Much pinching.
That's from Ecclesiasticus. You know, that's another little reminder. You know, see, he even opened with that one. Yeah, that's in the same league as him, wanting to parallel how the Son of Man expression was used in the book, the so-called Book of Enoch. Now, that one's, today even more controversial because that's not even in the Old Testament Apocrypha. That's in the Pseudepigrapha. note that little reminder that he was, he wasn't in many centuries hence, canonical mode about, what are the books of the Hebrew scriptures. But it is, in that, that's major subset of the Old Testament Apocrypha that are called the Deuterocanonical. That's why I mentioned Protestant, right? If you're Catholic, you would have grown up with that passage, but otherwise, not as likely. Notice how he paralleled that with something that is in the canon. Right? He grabbed that chunk out of Deuteronomy, where we again have waxing happening. It is interesting that he backed that one up with something that is in the, it's in the Pentateuch even, right? Little bit of a, we don't often delve too deeply into the precise parallels, but we have a couple more tonight we want to touch on, like we did last week, where, you have to sort of take note of, whoa, there's a contrast between what it says in the Bible. All right, anything else that someone was kind of noting in that lengthy paragraph there?
Not the paragraph itself. I'm wondering, the story behind the story. The reason for Jesus is this is quite a treatise to do, one-on-one. I know Jesus did a lot of one-on-one personal ministry, and we don't have the excerpts of what he said to those people. And, he dealt succinctly or to the point at other times, but they took a moment to tell this one to us. And, they also don't tell us anything about what happened to this kid after he was sent away, which might suggest nothing remarkable happened, which you might expect, but it's interesting. This is one of the longer paragraphs and one of the longer moments where Jesus does all these excerpts, just does basically an indexed search of the Old Testament. But you just wonder why this is here.
and that's a great question to ask because, not surprisingly, this has no parallel in the in the Bible, of course, right? I mean,
no.
In the New Testament, because this is totally off to the side. We could at least say that this guy wasn't, didn't disclose his one-on-one conversation to Luke or any of Luke's sleuths, right?
That's right. Right. And yet they included it. You think it has anything to do with the material comfort era in which we live?
Yeah, see, I mean, you
I see
that. That's a thing. The more you kind of appreciate, it's like, wow, why did they devote a whole bunch of lines, of the fifth epic of Revelation to this little vignette? Especially since, like Brad said, we know there's like thousands and thousands of really fantastic things, that discourses or one-on-ones that he had that they don't mention.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean they tell you point blank that he said some really really cool things, but we're not going to talk about them here. You're going what?
we'll talk about this one here though. Yeah.
But doesn't even the Gospel of John end with something about the myriad of stories that if they were put all together, that there wouldn't be enough books in the world to hold them or something. I'm not sure what the exact...
Yeah, you're right. There's
something
right. There's
along those lines.
Yeah. Those references in the New Testament, yes, like that. Here you are back to this thing. Why are they laying this out so much? And, gave it away at the beginning, by spending all that time on that first little paragraph. It's so natural. We don't want to, be too hard on this lad, right? Because if you move your face in closer to the words, you go, oh, wait a minute, that's me, right?
Yeah.
You'll see your reflection in the page. This is our natural tendency. Right? Think about how much time people spend on, on all the inheritance issues and how much money they spend. And we spend huge portions of our life, worrying about the details of the arrangement of molecules, before, during, and after we're alive.
Yeah.
And when someone tries to clarify our understanding and we say, that's kind of mean. I'm going to ask again because you didn't tell me what I wanted to hear. That's what this rejoinder paragraph is. He's like, I'm going to try it again. Maybe he'll soften it up now.
Especially, you can imagine, being talked to as he was, in a public setting before.
And right.
He had dealt harshly with him. The Jesus is trying to point out the problem here is not your brother and your dad's money. Okay, that's not the problem that we're facing here. You have a vacated region in your heart. Unfortunately, you've taken the unity of that inner domain and you've disrupted it. You've cavitated it with this issue.
That's scary.
Right? And this is just one of many bubbles. That we all kind of naturally have there. Remember, there's evil is very natural, right? So there's all kinds of evacuated, spaces within that inner domain because of stuff that you've drug in and up, right? That isn't tied to spirit substance, so it disrupts the unity up there, cavitates in the domain. Right. So, and in that little hollow, you know, there is a, you know, an infinitely reflected echo of yourself that you can fall in love with.
Not to you know, blast a trumpet as I put a coin into the coffer here, but you know, when my father died a few years ago, I talked about it here on Symmetry of Soul the day after it happened. There was no valid will that was left. You know, I just suggested to our family, you know, pretty firmly, the older son or whatever you want to. I just said, let's just go with what the law says here. And let's go with, you know, what we're pretty sure our dad, we knew him. We know what his intent would have been. Let's not fall to squabbling and parsing dimes here and dollars there. And thankfully, that's the way it turned out. And it didn't cost us much money to do the whole thing. We just let things play out. Turns out the law has covered some of this because tradition and authority have a lot to say about death and passing money on. So there's answers there. Like, all right, let's not worry about it.
Do you not know that the Jewish laws of inheritance will be justly administered? You will go with your complaint to the court of the synagogue?
Yeah, there it
I've
is.
I've lived it. And there was the court dealt with it just fine.
Yeah.
They all accepted it.
And sure, you know, we don't want to go back in the old mode. You know, where it's like, well, okay, we don't want to have any identification with material things, and so let's just bury everything with, you know, with Dad. Okay? I mean, yeah, but you want to catch yourself, right? You know, when he's thinking about, well, what's going to happen to all my stuff when I'm gone, right? And if he starts thinking too much about how this object gets eternalized this way, this object gets eternalized that way, right? You know, if you start thinking about how this stuff, you know, must, you know, and is going to go forward in time forever, I see, you know, no, eternity is tied to spiritual, not material. All right, so there's this, you know, you have to catch yourself. You know, it's one thing to think, you know, properly, practically about material affairs. It's another to eternalize them.
Right.
It's a fine line. It's very difficult because you eternalize it without thinking about it. Right? You're encircled in the Holy Spirit. And so it just happens automatically that you inappropriately throw in a little bit of spiritualization, eternalization of your material thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? We make an ism out of everything, right? You have to, you know, pull back on that consciously, right? Because if you don't consciously pull back, it's in play. Unconsciously, you will always be doing it, blending the spiritual into the material.
Yeah, it seems to be pretty natural.
It's just that's the way you come out of the can. And
yeah.
All right.
Equipment. Jesus sent the young man away, saying to him, "My son, what shall it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your own soul?"
Okay, so there's
that one.
Right. Right, you basically heard that, right? You know, we've got this, you know, he's made it specific, my son, etc. And you know, they told us this, you know, way back in paper 140, that he constantly reiterated, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?"
Mm-hmm.
Constantly reiterated. So it's not just a one-off, right? It, you know, and here it is. We just, you know, got it, and, you know, oh, but it got morphed and whatnot, you know, into the Bible. Different. No. I mean, he said it all the time. And he says it here again. So So he not only, you know, hit him with, you know, the Hebrew Scriptures' greatest hits, you know, but his greatest hits on this matter.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you bring up how he used something over and over again. I haven't really thought about how, you know, he must have had a 30-second elevator speech. He must have, you know, I mean, sure, he was always creative and always in the moment, but still, he still had things to get across to people.
Yeah, I think about basic. How many times I come back to, you know, some of my greatest hits. Over and over,
sure.
I repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
basic
and we're
themes.
Still a little,
I mean,
dense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they're basic themes that deserve to be reiterated.
Well,
yeah,
they're themes,
yeah,
that can also
kind of
become better assumptions. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of discover experientially there's a handful of ready statements that can be, you know, that embody a lot of generality so that they can be, you know, reiterated in multiple specific settings to, you know, and get reinforced that way and uplift,
yeah,
the specific, you know, also. It just,
mm-hmm,
you know, just kind of what you discover when you're encouraging people to abstract and then to seek truth, right, beyond the immediate facts. You know, this is just kind of a natural modality, so Jesus did it. Maybe just one other quick thing before we go on. You know, we're so often, you know, when they're quoting like this, they're using the King James wording, you know, like saying, and lose your own soul, where they throw in the word own, you know, which is kind of typically used just as to emphasize the possessive all the more. But think about, you know, in this context, the significance of it. You know, don't just treat it as, oh, yeah, that's just like an emphasizer. There's nothing really there, but, you know, like putting an underline under your. It's like, no, it's more than that. You know, your own soul. I mean, you know, remember, you know, you're sovereign. You know, it is really your possession.
Yeah, in the discussion about inheritance, the only thing he's saying you really own is your soul, your own soul, your owned soul.
Yeah, your
you
own.
Want to talk about losing
by
your
you
property,
soul.
What about losing your soul? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. The only real thing you're sovereign over and truly possess. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a number of times when they're paralleling the King James is very useful. You know, and for the unreflective eye, you go, well, yeah, they're just using kind of that old speak, you know. You know, it's a religious text, you know, and it, whoever wrote this thinks it, you know, gives it validity if you speak old school. It's like, no,
yeah,
it's never that. So, you know, even something that simple is an opportunity, see, for some reflection.
Food for thought. Bread for tomorrow. Andrea, care to take the reading from here?
Oh, Brad, I'm actually just finishing my dinner. Do you mind taking one more paragraph before I take over?
No problem.
Thanks.
To another standing nearby who asked Jesus how the wealthy would stand in the day of judgment, he replied, "I have come to judge neither the rich nor the poor, but the lives men live will sit in judgment on all. Whatever else may concern the wealthy in the judgment, at least three questions must be answered by all who acquire great wealth." And these questions are...
Go ahead.
Yeah. One, How much wealth did you accumulate? 2, how did you get this wealth? 3, how did you use your wealth?
Okay. This one is kind of, you were talking about why was that great big paragraph in there. Like, think about this little vignette. And, I mean, it just is left in this sort of opening little salvo, and then doesn't go anywhere. Very fascinating that he just apparently tees this up and leaves it open ended. As sort of a reflective homework assignment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of fascinating. Just that structural issue. And then that opening line, I have come to judge neither the rich nor the poor, but the lives men live will sit in judgment on all.
That's interesting.
That little reminder that if you want to think about using the word judgment here, kind of go old school, right? With good luck, bad luck sorts of thoughts, right? And think about the lives men live. Now everyone perforce has to marinate in that. If there are some unfortunate decisions that are made as those men live their lives, live in the consequences of those unfortunate decisions, the old school is we find ourselves beset by a misfortune. Right, that sense of the word judgment there, judgment on all. We find ourselves in the midst of a misfortune, which theology tells us, is the presence of the punishment of God upon us.
Unless you read the book of Job, that's the general going thought. Yes.
Right. Right. If you were struggling to kind of, what is he saying there? We'll sit in judgment on all. It's in kind of that old school sense, But see, the point is, for those who are students of the book, there's a number of places where they point out that the basic physics of living on a planet upon which you're not the only inhabitant. Like it or not, the consequences of others, are laughing at your ankles at best, right? If not laughing at your nostrils as you're trying to keep your head above water, right? We're all in this together. But anyway, he's playing off of that, and the other thing you can see he's trying to get him away from the whole immediacy of God, pointing the judgment finger at people, and just like get you to just reflect on this a little bit more, right? Just think about the health of your community, right? And, as you think about your wealth or your desire to accumulate wealth and whatnot, how much wealth did you accumulate? How did you get this wealth? How did you use your wealth? All of those questions that if you reflect on them will get you to reflect philosophically on the difference between true and false liberty.
Well, how's that?
Well, go back and read the true and false liberty section. What does it point out? You discover this liberty in your inner life, and then you initially kind of innocently flip that out into the external world and, you know, try to apply your sovereignty out there. It's like, no, you're not sovereign out there, right? And everyone isn't your subject. You know, and they all need to bow before, you know, your desires. So that, you know, that whole issue of, you know, it's fundamentally there's no problem with you having wealth, but right, do you get it? Did you get it and possess it and use it as if there are no others to consider?
Yeah.
Is it all about you because you've taken your, you know, inner liberty and applied it out there, right? As false liberty.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So you can see what he's, you know, you can appreciate that he's trying to do that with the questions there, you know, just because of how his first sentence. He says, okay, I didn't come here to judge the rich or the poor. It's like, set that whole old school judgment thing aside. Right? You know, think about the lives men live and how we all marinate in that, he says. He's trying to get them to, to bring in some more productive thoughts.
I see that now. It's clearer to see that, yeah. Huh. You know, before we read the last paragraph, go ahead, Chris, something else?
I was just going to comment. You know, just if you're reading a paragraph and there's a part of it that's confusing, you know, make sure you look for clues in other parts of the paragraph. Like I was just pointing out there, little simple techniques like that. It's like, well, maybe this is a repeat parallel of something, you know, that was said prior. Oh, yeah, okay, so there was a parallel to the setup, and it's being repeated. I get it now. Right? You know, remember how the book is a philosophic, see, so it's got that kind of sophistication to it.
Right. Yeah, good hint.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Brad.
But before we read the last paragraph, I was just trying to remind myself of the more whole context here, because the next section is more about wealth. I'm like, how do we get on this whole thing? And I mean, it reminds me of this. It seems like the common theme. So Jesus was giving this sermon, and it was about a lot of stuff about, look, you know, things are going to get tough pretty soon, but they can't mess with, you know, they can kill your body, but they can't affect you. Have no fear, fear not. But somewhere along the way, he used the word pennies, and somewhere along the way, he used the word inheritance. Spiritual inheritance, and that was enough for the whole rest of the conversation to be about material inheritance for hours.
Yeah.
Forget all that other stuff.
Yes. You know, and which, the only thing that gives him a break is what we're about to read, right? But then as soon as he's up again, the apostles are going, so we hear you're talking about wealth. Ooh, more, more, more.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Then Jesus went into his tent to rest for a while before the evening meal. When the apostles had finished with the baptizing, they came also and would have talked with him about wealth on earth and treasure in heaven, but he was asleep. It was raining. He was asleep. There was a storm outside the boat, but the master slept soundly, you know, things like that.
Yeah, he needed to take a break. It's like again, you see, the more he, you know, they hit him with these material things, I mean, the more material gravity he feels within himself, and the more, right, he's going to need to take a nap, because it's draining. Right? When spiritual gravity is holding you up more, you know, you don't feel the weight of the material as much, and you know you can get by with less sleep. but it's, you know, it's draining. It's taxing when you've got that material gravity pulling on you.
Yeah.
You need a break.
That's an interesting point.
Yes.
Huh.
Okay,
okay,
you
Andrea,
go
you
want to?
Yeah, go ahead. Go for it. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Section 5 talks to the apostles on wealth. That evening after supper, when Jesus and the 12 gathered together for their daily conference, Andrew asked, "Master, while we were baptizing the believers, you spoke many words to the lingering multitude, which we did not hear. Would you be willing to repeat these words for our benefit?" And in response to Andrew's request, Jesus said,
"I already, you know, talked about that, lead in there." Okay, he's up. Come on now. Now repeat everything you said before that giant sucking sound. I want to hear it all again.
All right, repeat these words.
Well, and that's why they're repeating it here in the book, because they know it's something we're all interested in. And I think the more money you make, the more you're interested, because it becomes a concern. If you're poor, you don't really care.
Now, the other thing, you know, before you start reading, we're now back to the Gospel of Luke. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're picking up where we left off in chapter 12 of Luke.
Okay? Oh, okay.
And continuing on.
Right.
Remember, we were last there when we were talking about the rich fool.
Right.
Okay, so here we are. We're back again. It just picks up right where it left off, paralleling Luke. You know, and remember that they're, you know, the midwares are very much paralleling, you know, the wording, phrasing, order, in Luke, you know, even when we get to the lilies, don't think Matthew, think Luke.
Yeah.
And fleshing that out, you know, sorting it, clarifying it, you know, filling in the gaps and, you know, giving you the full statement.
Okay. All right. Yes. Andrew, I will speak to you about these matters of wealth and self-support, but my words to you, the apostles, must be somewhat different from those spoken to the disciples and the multitude, since you have forsaken everything, not only to follow me, but to be ordained as ambassadors of the kingdom. Already have you had several years' experience, and you know that the Father, whose kingdom you proclaim, will not forsake you. You have dedicated your lives to the ministry of the kingdom. Therefore, be not anxious or worried about the things of the temporal life, what you shall eat, nor yet for your body, what you shall wear. The welfare of the soul is more than food and drink. The progress in the spirit is far above the need of raiment. When you are tempted to doubt the sureness of your bread, consider the ravens. They sow not, neither reap. They have no storehouses or barns, and yet the Father provides food for every one of them that seeks it. And of how much more value are you than many birds? Besides, all of your anxiety or fretting doubts can do nothing to supply your material needs. Which of you, by anxiety, can add a handbreadth to your stature or a day to your life? Since such matters are not in your hands, why do you give anxious thought to any of these problems?
Yeah, because I'm an animal origin blob of protoplasm. Give me a break.
Because you gave me an amygdala.
I was drawn this way, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I was drawn this way, exactly. Good reference. So here we are. We want to come back to that opening sentence this evening. And we want to note something that is very definitively clarified. The beginning of this, what Jesus said, that's not in Luke. Okay. In Luke, you know, it starts up with the therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, etc. You know, we're here, it says, therefore be not anxious or worried. Okay, that's where it starts in Luke. It's missing that whole first block. And in Luke, all you have is this, you know, is the predicate. Then Jesus said to his disciples. Okay, so that everything that follows, like consider the lilies and whatnot, appears to be much more general than what it was. It says, but my words to you, the apostles, must be somewhat different from those spoken to the disciples and the multitude.
See, that sorts it out right there for everybody.
Yeah, but for 2,000 years, right, this has been overplayed. Yeah, I mean, the apostles were disciples, right, as he said there, not only to follow me, right, that's a disciple, but to be ordained as ambassadors of the kingdom.
Yeah.
Right? You've got the 12, right, that this is specific to. And when you generalize beyond that, you overplay it, you know, as so many have been wont to do for 2,000 years because of how, you know, it's told in Luke, for instance.
Yeah.
Right, these sorts of things, right, are told
right.
in Luke, for instance. Because obviously there's other places that, you know, where this comes up. Jesus was speaking in a very specific way. You know, it gets into the New Testament in this very generalized way, and, you know, and hence it's people go off on false tangents with it. So that's, you know,
yeah,
that's the key, you know, and it takes us back to Jesus did not teach nor countenance improvidence, idleness, indifference to providing the physical necessities for one's family or dependence upon alms. With
yeah,
just a little asterisk, okay, you know, he did talk about some of that relative to his 12 apostles.
Right.
Okay. But not beyond that.
Right.
That's what the, you know, that's, you know, so we immediately see why those mid, you know, the midwayers put that sentence in there that we dwelled on so long.
When was Luke written? Wasn't that like 30 years after Jesus' death?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, all this stuff is being, you know, written, you know, down the road.
They're
from
lucky
Jesus'
they
life.
Remembered as, yeah, they're lucky they remembered as much as they did. Too bad they got this first part of it, though, you know, discriminating between apostles and disciples.
Yeah, you know, and
well,
think about it. You
know,
this is Luke,
yeah.
You know, that's writing the Gospel of Luke, who wasn't there at all.
Yeah, right.
Some of the apostles wrote down, they explained to us, you know, some of the sayings and doings, you know, pretty soon after, like Andrew wrote some things down. So they, you know, they began to put the pieces together, but it was not compiled sometime later.
So just and we'll see here in a little bit. We got to remember, you know, like I said, we're paralleling Luke, and I'll explain what I mean by drawing an underline under his name like that. You know, lest anyone forget you know, caveat emptor when you're reading Luke, as the revelators point out, because he had some biases that he fed in, right? You know, and you know, somehow the first part not getting in there is his bias.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I'll explain more here in a little bit when it's, you know, immediately, you know, before us.
Okay. All right. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. Yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. God so clothes
the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is cut down and cast into the fire, how much more shall he clothe you, the ambassadors of the heavenly kingdom? Oh, you of little faith, when you wholeheartedly devote yourselves to the proclamation of the gospel of the kingdom, you should not be of doubtful mind concerning the support of yourselves or the families you have forsaken. If you give your lives truly to the gospel, you shall live by the gospel. If you are only believing disciples, you must earn your own bread and contribute to the sustenance of all who teach and preach and heal. If you are anxious about your bread and water, wherein are you different from the nations of the world who so diligently seek such necessities? Devote yourself to your work, believing that both the Father and I know that you have need of all these things. Let me assure you once and for all that if you dedicate your lives to the work of the kingdom, all your real needs shall be supplied. Seek the greater thing, and the lesser will be found therein. Ask for the heavenly, and the earthly shall be included. The shadow is certain to follow the substance.
Ooh, he even throws in a little Plato parallel there, right? As he was wont to do over and over. Okay, I mean, this is the biggie, right? I mean, you know, we got now, oh, you of little faith, even, right? that passage, consider the lilies, right? Almost every, one has, has some relationship to this, and they have it out of context, right? Right? When he says you, right, yet I say to you, right, everyone reads it, oh, he's talking to me. No, he's not talking to you. He's talking to the 12 apostles. Right? They toil not, neither do they spin.
Right.
He's not talking to Bob or Betty or Chris. Right? And, notice that again, you've got a clarification that didn't really make it into Luke. If you are only believing disciples, you must earn your own bread and contribute to the sustenance of all who teach and preach and heal.
Yeah, well, it's understandable that they forgot that part because they're like, well, we're not just that. They just forgot the part that they think didn't apply to them. So, but we're off to 2,000 years of mystical disconnected thinking because of this passage.
Yeah. Quite a shame.
Yeah.
And you could put it on. Exactly. How did it get from the apostles hearing this and remembering it, and how did it finally end up, getting penned down by Luke? It's like, there's some of it a little bit in Matthew, there's specifics that are, only there in Luke, and so, but it's more than that, like I said, and we'll see this here in the next paragraph very directly. Right. Coincidentally, when you're reading, what Jesus said in Luke, and I'm putting, air quotes around coincidentally, obviously, not so coincidentally, in other words. His bias, is constantly there. I mean, he would have interviewed all kinds of people and heard all kinds of stories and had, pre-existing documents. And, but what does, what really captures his imagination and what does he write down? Right? It's going through his filter. Okay? And a lot of things would have been yada, yada, yada in his mind. Okay, now there's a juicy tidbit. I got to put that in. And I'll even expand on it a little bit.
Yeah. What was Luke's concept frame?
What was his agenda? See, mm-hmm. even more than his concept frame, right, what was his agenda? He had an agenda. And I'll, you know, like I said, when we look at the next paragraph, I'll remind everyone specifically about that, because the Revelators specifically bring it up. Again, Pat, back where we were before in paper 140. Coincidentally. go ahead here with the next paragraph, whoever's going to be reading.
Kermit, you want to go ahead and take over?
Sure, I'll be happy to do that. You are only a small group, but if you have faith, if you will not stumble in fear, I declare that it is my Father's good pleasure to give you this kingdom. You have laid up your treasures where the purse waxes not old, where no thief can despoil, and where no moth can destroy. And as I told the people, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
Okay. So, that's, because he repeated that last line, that's how it got in, into Luke. It wasn't, from what he said before, when he said it before. Okay, so all seems pretty straightforward until you look at the parallels to this paragraph in Luke. Okay, and Luke basically has that first sentence, about pleasure to give you this kingdom, and then he has those subsequent thoughts, bringing in purse analogies. But Luke inserted something in between. What we have here where it says, this kingdom period you have laid, in between those two sentences, Luke says, sell your possessions and give to the poor.
Oh, dear. That's where it came from.
Yeah. Point blank, just period. Sell your possessions and give to the poor.
Sounds a little like a commune.
Yeah, so back there in paper, in paper 140, there's a section, great big long section, section 8. It's where they have these things where they're talking about the political attitude and the social attitude and stuff, and people who might remember that, these big kind of subsections. And then one about the economic attitude, that's where they mentioned about, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? That's where I was pointing out that he constantly reiterated that. Well, right before they say that, they say, he never taught his followers to avoid earthly possessions, only his 12 apostles.
Yeah.
Luke, the physician, was a strong believer in social equality. And he did much to interpret Jesus' sayings in harmony with his personal beliefs.
And there it is.
Luke was constantly, trying to put forward the agenda of the redistribution of wealth.
It's very popular today.
Yes. One of the tenets of progressivism. That was Luke, way ahead of his time, if you will.
Decidedly modern, decidedly 20th century.
Social equality. He was a social justice warrior, right? And he's putting the redistribution of wealth into Jesus' mouth. Jesus said, this has been a problem for 2,000 years, and it's one of these issues that is beginning to come to a head. Hence the Revelators devoting an extended discussion, about that and, other things of its ilk, right, and, being, you know, a very unfortunate, fallacious worldview that's driving mankind right now.
Right.
And so, and it brings up that all of that discussion, and you see it very definitively here. And like I said, you see it point blank there where he inserts that sentence. But everything else, see, is also colored that way. Right?
Hmm.
So that it gets overly generalized. Right? You know, and people don't go, oh, wait, no, that's just about the apostles. He's not, you know, he's not saying that we should all do that. But Luke is saying that you should all do that.
Yeah. You got to wonder, just like today, how much of that was conscious or not conscious on Luke's part. People have their frames of mind, their agendas. They hear what they want to hear. And without knowing it, he may have just sort of thought he heard it said this way. Even if they directly look him in the eye and said, now, Jesus only told us, the apostles, to sell all our possessions. He's like, oh, yeah, yeah, sell all your possessions. Yeah. All
right. And they put those words right in Jesus' mouth, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Jesus did not teach nor countenance improvidence, idleness, etc., but Luke did.
Luke did.
Right. In Jesus' name.
Yeah.
Okay. Like you're saying, okay, you can give him the benefit of the doubt, right? But see, I mean, it's, you know, and go beyond the specific, right? How many people, right, well, have issues with their old wineskins? Everyone. Right? Everything you hear, you only think you hear. Right? You know, I mean, technically all you can hear is what your concept frame allows to be spoken in your mind.
Yeah.
You know,
right? I mean,
Paul,
there's many things that your concept frame won't, you know, can't, support. Right? Those thoughts just can't form in your mind with that concept frame.
Yeah.
The power of them.
I was going to say that, Paul did a similar, thing with Jesus'
course.
Gospel. But they termed
and
him
so did
a
Matthew.
Keen and they termed him a keen theologic traitor.
Traitor,
sure. T-R-A-D-E-R, right? But it doesn't seem this way so much with Luke here. It seems not as, I don't know, they don't say anything about it. So
again, just, you know, why don't the Gospels why aren't they all in perfect sync? Because one is Matthew's worldview, one is Mark's worldview, one is Luke's worldview, one is John's worldview. Right, the life and teachings of Jesus put in a limited and, if you want to be direct about it, false concept frame.
Yeah.
So the authoritative elimination of error is what we're attempting to find. But it can only be that. I mean, Jesus was an authoritative elimination of error, too.
And they didn't hear him either.
Right? So, right, how much like Luke are you? How much like Matthew are you? How much like Paul are you, et cetera? Right? These are sobering questions to ask oneself.
Yeah.
It's like, tell me more, Jesus, about the redistribution of wealth. Or tell me about how you shouldn't get all fixated on the future, because, I think a future time orientation is racist. So I think you should teach, and you did teach, improvidence. See? This is the way we roll as we try to read this, the way it would have been 2,000 years ago if we tried to listen to what Jesus was saying to us.
Just
everyone just needs to appreciate this is what you're up against. You're up against yourself. Right? Kind of like what Jesus said, now don't worry about, being judged, thumbs up, thumbs down. Okay, the big issue is yourself to start with. Now, let's work on that, not worrying about whether or not you're going to be judged thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Let's start with know thyself, said Jesus. Hmm. Others have had that advice.
Yeah, predating him, yes.
Oh, yes.
Predating him, yes. He just, right, you know, drew an allusion to Plato there.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Okay. But in the work which is just ahead of us, and in that which remains for you, after I go to the Father, you will be grievously tried. You must all be on your watch against fear and doubts. Every one of you, gird up your loins of your minds, and let your lamps be kept burning. Keep yourselves like men who are watching for their master to return from the marriage feast, so that when he comes back and knocks, you may quickly open to him. Such watchful servants are blessed by the master who finds them faithful at such a great moment. Then will the master make his servants sit down while he himself serves them. Verily, verily, I say to you that a crisis is just ahead in your lives, and it behooves you to watch and be ready.
Okay, so it fleshes out the details and eliminates some of the superfluous stuff, right, in the parallel in Luke. But it's relatively straightforward, and you know, it's kind of there in essence in Luke. No biggies here. But just, you know, as that thing ended, you know, behooves you to watch and be ready. You know, your mind should have immediately kind of gone to, oh, I know what the apostles are thinking when he says words like that, right? Because I've read the the New Testament. I know how they rolled forward with thoughts like that about, you know, watching and being ready. Yeah. So I'll be specific about what I'm hinting at here. Read the next paragraph.
Yeah. You well understand that no man would suffer his house be broken into if he knew what hour the thief was to come. Be you also on watch for yourselves, for in an hour that you least suspect and in a manner you think not, shall the Son of Man depart.
There it is at the end. Depart. But if you look in Luke, it says...
He says...
You also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you did not expect him.
Yeah. He got that 180 degrees out, didn't he?
Right. Jeez. You know how this rolled forward subsequent to his right, what he said. It was all about the second coming.
Right.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons they were delayed in writing stuff down was because they knew the second coming was any moment.
Right, right.
It's like, no, he said depart, not come.
Oh, man. You know, it's really, you know, you hear, you go over all this stuff. It's like the movie that you keep watching and you know how it ends, but you keep hoping it'll end differently, and it never does.
It never does.
It never does. No, no, don't choose that. No.
I think we should split up. It's like, no, don't split up.
That doesn't end well. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So here we go again.
Yeah. See, notice how, you know, because of our concept frames, humans turn straightforward things into drama. It seemed like a good idea at the time for the two of them to split up, you know, so they could search more in the same length of time. Right? And then they were both eaten by the monster.
right.
Yeah. It's like, no. Right. The thing that was short term was him departing, not him coming again.
Right.
That's another 180.
I look at what Jesus was trying to do here. I think back to our study on Jesus faces death, the events to come. He's even trying to be vivid. Gird the loins of your minds. Let your lamps be kept burning. That's the kind of stuff you could say over a campfire at night that might stick in their minds. That's evocative. And yet they all just went comatose and lost their minds completely. They turned into blubbering fools when Jesus was arrested. They couldn't. He tried the best he could, but they were still people of their day.
Yeah, what about grievously tried? Don't you grasp?
He told us this would happen, and yet they all panicked. Yeah.
But then you have to just think about, as we've talked about, when the Gospels got written and why they were delayed and all the sort of processing that went on, at the time when they were hearing and then subsequent the fact that we can peel all that back and get to what was actually said and what the context was of what he actually said and that coordinated essential knowledge now allows you to get the truth, right, that you can't get from the stories in the Gospels.
Yeah.
At least not as much, right?
right.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah. You can get more to the substance of the truth now instead of just the shadows of truth, right, in the muddled stories.
Yeah. For some minutes, the 12 sat in silence. Some of these warnings they had heard before, but not in the setting presented to them at this time.
Yeah, there's the around the campfire thing that Brad was painting, right?
Right.
Yeah, and one of the things, even though they are, of course, the midwayers are paralleling, the words in Luke, right? Their selection of words are anchored therein. One can note, at times when they don't have to change things or add too much. The apostles remembered. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can always kind of be fascinated by it. It's like, how did they manage to hold on to as much as they did?
Yeah,
I agree.
Well, it was a different time. Everyone held on to more than we do now because there wasn't a lot of writing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you had
a lot of
more. People were skilled in remembering like we aren't these days.
Yeah, they didn't have notepads sitting around, sketchbooks, and
or access to every book that's ever been written. It's a thing in the palm of your hand or whatever, right? All these crutches that we have for our minds now. Now, anyway.
And we wax fat on them. Oh, well. Wax.
Yes.
More wax.
Are you alluding to Wally?
I might as well be. It's a tale for our times. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. That's a really cool study. We all know that there's authoritative elimination of error in here, but to see them reversing things that are 180 degrees out of sync in one of the Gospels, when necessary, without fear. That's what they do. We'll cover more next week. Until then, follow the way.
God bless all.
Good night, everyone.
Take care, everyone. Love you all. Have a fantastic week. And his peace be upon you.